out behind our name tags?
I'm behind the water bill, so nobody can call on me.
Okay. And we got three mics, so we can split the mics. Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Doyle Rice. I'm the weather reporter at USA Today. And today we're here for the 2 o'clock session on mega droughts, a threat to civilization, which sounds pretty exciting. Hopefully we'll bring some life to the otherwise dry topic. We're joined by four distinguished scholars up here. First, we have Brian Fuchs, who's the associate geoscientist and climatologist at the National Drought Mitigation Center and University of Nebraska. Next, we have Jay Lund, who's the director of the Center for Watershed Sciences and the professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of California, Davis. Next, Gary McManus, state climatologist, right here at the Oklahoma Climatological Survey at University of Oklahoma. And at the far end there, we have Jonathan Overpeck, also known as Peck, professor of geosciences and atmospheric sciences, and co-director of the Institute of the Environment at the University of Arizona. So right now, I think we're just going to go ahead and have each panelist kind of just give a little bit of a few sentences about themselves and about mega droughts in general, and then I'll ask a few questions, and then we'll open it up to the audience for questions. So first in line is Brian.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you, Doyle, for the invitation to come and be part of the panel today. As Doyle said, my name is Brian Fuchs, and I'm a climatologist at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. And what the group I'm associated with is the National Drought Mitigation Center, and I've been there for a little over 10 years now. Primary duties I'm involved in with is really with drought monitoring, so the weekly drought monitor map that I'm sure many of you have looked at. I'm one of the authors of that, and also there's a North American drought monitor product that we work with Canada and Mexico with that comes out monthly that I'm also a part of. As far as mega droughts go, a lot of the work that we do at the Drought Mitigation Center does look at past drought events as well as what's happening now and into the future. And with that, we have come across evidence through many different data sets about past events that would fall under this category of mega drought, meaning these droughts that last for 10, 15 years or longer. And we've been able to show evidence of these. And the thing with some of the talk with climate change and projections into the future is the idea of these occurrences becoming more common. And so with the work we do, a lot of the focus at the Drought Mitigation Center is on mitigation and planning. And so we are striving to continue to help stakeholders with this idea that planning for these events may become more commonplace, and having an adequate plan for these drought periods that last longer is going to be needed as well. So as far as mega droughts go, I think we will continue to see them. We've seen them in the past. They just may become a little more frequent.
We've done a lot of work with droughts because we work in California. And half of, well, at least a third of California water problems are droughts. Another third is floods, and the other third is water quality. So we sort of have the trifecta. California's had some really severe droughts back in the Middle Ages. A couple of droughts that you had maybe half the mean annual flow for 150, 200 years a few times. And one of the things we did in our computer modeling, which is the other thing that I do to try to make sense of these, is we made a computer model of what would California's economy do today, or in the next 20 years, if we had a repeat of that paleo drought, you know, that occurred in the Middle Ages. And it was really interesting, and it was really surprising, in that really civilization would not come to an end in California if you lost half the water. You would lose a lot of the agriculture, which is 80% of our water use, human water use, and you would certainly have a lot of problems with the environment. But the cities are all sufficiently high value, because we're one of the wealthiest parts on Earth, that we'd find ways to get around it, largely by buying water from agriculture, which has some additional agricultural economic impacts. But since we live in a global economy, we're not going to starve. It's not like if you had these mega droughts back in the Middle Ages, you had famine and pestilence and civilizations coming to the end and moving around. Today, in a global economy, we don't have that. We have some movements and economic losses, but fortunately we avoid the famine and pestilence, and I view it with great shame that it's not my profession that's responsible for this. It's not because we're managed water better now, it's because we exist in a global economy because we have global transportation systems and markets. And I thought that was really amazing. So this paper that we wrote, which was in 2010, got picked up last year in the drought in the LA Times, and a week or so after that, they had an LA Times editorial cartoon about this story that mentioned our model. And I think it's probably the only case of an engineering professor ever getting his model, computer model, into an editorial cartoon in a major newspaper. So I'm really proud.
Welcome to Norman, everyone, my hometown here where I work. I hail from the Oklahoma Panhandle, the home of probably the most famous drought in American history. The Dust Bowl was coined in the Oklahoma Panhandle back in 1935. Of course, Oklahoma is coming off of one of its worst droughts of record, probably in the last 50 years, probably since the 1950s drought, the fall 2010 through spring of 2015 drought. Working with Brian at the National Drought Mitigation Center, a lot of my time has been spent over the last 5 years going out and speaking to stakeholders, especially agriculture as an agricultural state. It's one of the prime impacts whenever we have a drought of that nature is the agricultural communities are devastated. I've given over 140 talks over the last 4.5 years, so that tells you just how much importance is placed upon drought in Oklahoma. And of course, we know that the Dust Bowl drought was a good 10-year drought. With mega droughts, we know, judging from paleoclimate evidence, of course, in this area, that droughts have lasted even longer. There was a 25-year drought from 1850 to 1875 that devastated the ranching industry out in the Texas Panhandle. And of course, when that occurred, those ranches were broken up into farmland and later sold to entrepreneurs, which later set the stage during the Dust Bowl drought for the Dust Bowl disaster, the erosion that occurred. So all of these things are interconnected. And, you know, at the time, as we came into spring here, I thought we were possibly in another mega drought. It was only 5 years in. And then, of course, we had our wettest April through July on record with, you know, some parts of the state had over 50 inches of rain in 2.5 months. And then, of course, we go through a 2-month period without any rainfall and a nice upper-level high-level pressure system sitting over the state. Our normal heat dome that comes during the summer, and now we're right back into drought, and I'm having to bug Brian every week and going out and speak again. So with the Great Plains and the Southern Plains, it's a little bit different than out west. Our mega droughts are probably a different source at times, but you know, whenever we look at Oklahoma, the variability of our weather, it provides just about everything. But we do know that those droughts of the past can come back. We hope they don't come back, but some of the projections that we've spoken about before show that they possibly will. And so it's my job as state climatologist to prepare our stakeholders for that eventuality.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. It's nice to be here. And my perspective really comes from working on drought for an awful long time as a paleoclimatologist. So study using tree rings and lake sediments and caves and other types of proxy evidence to see how our record of drought in this century compares to the drought going back centuries and millennia. And I've worked on drought in all the continents on the planet now except Europe and Antarctica, and I have active programs on all those continents now. And what we're finding is that in just about every place around the world, there's an instrumental record of drought, and there are long droughts in that instrumental record. You know, for example, in North America, we have the Dust Bowl, and the ones we've been talking about, we have the drought that's been going on in the upper basin of the Colorado and Arizona for now since around 2000, so new millennium drought. But these aren't really mega droughts when it comes to the big picture. I like to think of the California drought that Jay mentioned earlier. Yes, the Scott-Stein drought and also the droughts in the 19th century out here. But the droughts that really, there are two ways to define it. There are multiple ways to define them, but when we first defined the term, there were droughts that are much longer than what we see in the instrumental record, and if they were to occur again, would have large societal impacts. Another way to define them is multi-decadal drought. And there are other ways, more technical ways. But you know, bear in mind that a mega drought in the Amazon, where they don't get long droughts, might only be 15 years, where a mega drought in the Sahel, where we've seen droughts as you know multi-decadal already in the instrumental record, are 100 years long, or Australia 100 years long, or monsoon Asia, the longest drought we've seen in India, 25 years. Okay, but then again, you know, that's the normal. And what we've been doing is trying to estimate what are the odds we get a drought under normal circumstances, and we found that the climate models we use to project future climates aren't too good at doing these mega droughts. In fact, even though we know we've had droughts 100 years long or 50 years long in the Southwest, the models don't simulate those. No models simulate those. So we have to bias correct those models, and we find that a mega drought lasting 50 years, the risk of that is 8% in any 50-year period of the near future. Okay. The big difference, though, is that's normal. And the big point I wanted to make today is that we're obviously not in normal anymore. We're warming the earth. And a big component of drought that people tend to not think about, particularly lay people, is temperature. Okay, part of it's precipitation, but part of it's temperature and the feedbacks that perpetuate and make droughts more severe. And in the future, because of the temperature increase, we're going to see more and more severe droughts and longer droughts. And for example, the California drought has a large temperature component, the current one, that's made it a lot worse. The drought in the Colorado River Basin has been made worse by temperature. And the most recent paper talking about the Southwest and the High Plains suggests that whereas a 50-year long drought, the risk of that is only about 8-10% under normal conditions. Once you add in global warming, it goes up over 80% by the end of this century. Okay, and that's work done by Ben Cook and colleagues. Ben is a NASA scientist, Toby Ault at Cornell, and this was published just a few months ago. So we do have to adapt to mega drought no matter what we do, but certainly we're going to have to adapt to a whole nother type of mega drought if we let climate change go unchecked.
Thanks very much. Looks like we've answered some of the basic questions here, as like what is a mega drought. I think we kind of have a good sense that it's a duration, not necessarily intensity, and mega droughts can last different lengths depending on different parts of the world. At what point do you think we could qualify or describe the current drought in California as potentially slipping into one of these? I mean, even if we have a winter of a phenomenal El Nino, I mean, which would, you know, do a great, hopefully, knock out some of the drought there. I mean, at what point do you think it's fair to say we could be slipping into one now?
We're in the fourth year of drought now. The last two drought years have been particularly severe, among the driest of record, but not the driest of record. The kind of drought where, if the drought were to end today, we would probably say that this drought is about the kind of drought you expect to see about once a generation. And maybe with climate warming, a few other things that are going on, maybe twice, maybe three times a generation, which I think sociologically really changes it. If this drought continues, most of our drought response so far, particularly in agriculture, has been to pump more groundwater. And that's not sustainable over a very, very long time, but it is sustainable over probably another 5 years. In terms of the overall state, it'll be a gradual, slow failure rather than all of us jumping off of a cliff at once. You know, for your individual well, it's a cliff when your well goes dry, but they'll only go dry at a rate of probably less than 1% per year. So it'll have to go on quite, 10 years, I would say, for it to really be a mega drought. California is really set up for droughts. I'd like to tell people that every year California has a drought that's worse than the rest of the United States, or eastern part of the United States, has ever seen in geologic time, because we have these dry summers in a Mediterranean climate.
Sure. Yeah, I think this winter is going to be really interesting, not as just a scientist, but as anyone. But from a drought perspective, one of the things I learned when I was on sabbatical in Australia was, they look at drought down there, and they're a dry country. They look at drought down there as whether or not they get an event that breaks the drought. Down there it's La Niñas that break their droughts, whereas here it's El Niños. So most of the time when we get an El Niño, California gets good moisture, and if you were following Twitter, Dan Swain just tweeted a nice piece suggesting how the latest forecasts are for definitely a wet winter in California. But what if that didn't happen? I think that's what gives rise to the mega droughts. And so during the 19th century, for example, I've been working down in the tropical Pacific trying to understand El Nino better. And during the 19th century, there were times when El Nino was not interannual, not happening every, 4, 5, 10 years, but was a longer period between the big events. And probably in deeper history, that is our best estimate is that we had much longer periods without El Nino, and that was probably the reason we got our mega droughts here. We haven't proven that yet, but I think we really keep an eye on this El Nino. If for some reason California doesn't get a whole bunch of rain, that drought could more easily turn into something really serious. And El Ninos don't typically give us big snow in the upper basin of the Colorado, so we're all looking at that pretty closely too. And I'd say the odds of the California drought getting good relief this winter, maybe not ending, but getting good relief, are pretty good, whereas the Colorado drought, not as good.
And I'm by no means am I an expert drought modeler. I'm an expert drought reactor, let's put it that way, and I've had a lot of practice over the last 5 years. But I am an interpreter of the science, of all of these sciences, for the state of Oklahoma, for the state decision makers, for the layperson. And one of the things that worries me is that we are basing how well this El Nino is going to do on the previous 5 or 6 really strong El Ninos that occurred before. But when I look back at those, even the 97 El Nino event, it was a much different world back then as far as climate goes. We had a lot more of the Arctic Ocean covered up by ice throughout the summer and early fall during that time period. We didn't have this big blob of warm water that these Californians are enjoying so much with all the great white sharks and all the other types of marine mammals coming up from other parts. And so when we start to do these analogs, we say, well, look at 97, 98, and 82, 83, 72, 73, 56, 57. It wasn't the same atmosphere then, if that makes sense. And so when I tell people, it tips the odds in favor of us seeing this drought that we're now going back into in Oklahoma to get eradicated once again, it doesn't mean El Nino is going to behave the same way that it did in the past. And also, the 56-57 drought was extremely dry here in the Midwest and the Great Plains and the Southern Plains. So whenever we start talking El Nino, we always have to give that caveat that it has to behave the way it's supposed to, and it has to behave the way it did 20 years ago, and it's not necessarily going to do that. So I've been preaching that, we might break our all-time wettest year on record here in Oklahoma, and I did that back in July. And then August came, and then September came, and now October's here, and now 57 is again far outpacing 2015. So, even us climatologists make these type of predictions that possibly we should have held off on a little bit.
And just adding on that, and I concur with Gary that we have seen these ENSO events in the past decade not behave as past ENSO events. There was a La Nina event down in the southeast that everyone was pegging this was going to be the event that breaks the drought down here. And we went through a La Nina event that acted completely opposite of what the others had acted like. Last winter, we also threw around a term that had not been used that much out in the western U.S., and that was a snow drought. We had the temperature component, which is becoming a very much a key player, at least more recognizable than what some scientists have seen in the past, and I think even for the layperson to see that the temperature component, not only in the lower levels, but in the upper levels, the mountains, where there are places in California that were close to normal precipitation for last year, but it came all as rain. And so this whole management system that's set up throughout the entire western U.S. of winter snows, harvesting that water through this network of reservoirs, canals, and rivers, pushing water from where it's plentiful to areas where it's not as plentiful, got challenged in a big way last year. And I think we're going to continue to see these challenges. The infrastructure that's set up to deal with these events may need to change as well.
Yeah, I'll ask one more question and then open it up to the floor. I think I wrote in one story over the last year or so that the 20th century was kind of an anomaly in the paleoclimatic record. And as far as wetness in the West, not to ignore the Great Plains, but that in the West, that maybe we were kind of fooled into thinking that it was a different kind of a climate than it really is. Am I right thinking that maybe in the last hundreds, a couple millennia, that it was an unusually wet century, and so we're living under a kind of an illusion out there?
Yeah, so I personally believe that you're absolutely right, that we had quite a wet century. We're trying to show that in a convincing way, and it's difficult to do for a variety of reasons, but in order to do that, you have to show, you have to know what the previous centuries were like. And a lot of our paleoclimatic proxy records, like trees, aren't just responding to precipitation variability. They're responding to changes in their growth. And so the slowest changes that are taking place in a tree's anatomy as it grows older and older have to do a lot with growth as well as with climate. And so University of Arizona has the oldest tree ring laboratory with, gosh, we must have 15 people in the faculty there. And they're very clever at figuring out how to get this low frequency component out of it. And some work of some recent graduates suggests that we've had an anomalously wet, at least in the Colorado River Basin, century. I don't know about California.
Well, I think the same is true for California, for Oklahoma, and that is we've had a period, not just the last 100 years, but really a period of about 30 to 35 years where we were greatly above normal in precipitation compared to the last 100 to 120 years. So 1980 through about 2005, we had this period where we were much above normal and unusually consistently above normal in rainfall across the state. And so you think about that, and you have a whole generation or two of people that grew up with this abundance of water, and the infrastructure of the state is built upon that water, and the agriculture has modified itself to being able to use that much water. So different strains of wheat, for instance, are planted that aren't as drought resistant. Different breeds of cattle are used or bred that aren't drought resistant. And then so whenever you have one of these droughts, even just a five-year drought, it's really a shock to the system when these can be society changers. And you know, that's one of the points that we make when we go out and speak, is that some of those lessons that our predecessors learned from the 1930s and 1950s, those have gone, you know, out of everybody's collective memory. And so we need to start talking to those folks that grew up in the 50s again. The 30s, it's, you know, they're starting to pass away, unfortunately, but those stories live on. Is what is it like to live through a drought, a 5 to 10 year drought and longer drought? Because again, those types of experiences are out of our collective memories, and that's an important thing for society to remember. What's it like to not have water?
I can still talk to people in California that I meet that came to California a few generations ago in the 1930s drought.
Oh, sure.
What's right. It really highlights to me, I think, the change in character of droughts in our society now. Today, Oklahoma's economy is not nearly as based on agriculture as much as it was then. Same thing with California. The structure of our societies and of our economies are much less susceptible to mega droughts than they were in the past, and thank goodness for that. I don't really know whether it's gotten wetter or drier in California compared to over 500 years. In the instrumental record, we've got about 120 years of stream flow data, maybe 150 years or so of precipitation data. When you plot that over long periods, you don't see a real big trend. But you look at the Scott Stein droughts, the stuff that he found in the 1880s, and other folks have confirmed really up and down the state, and then you look at, well, just the statistics of the coefficient of variation of precipitation in California compared to the rest of the country, and you got to say, well, we got to expect this. We live in a dry place with a high, with a lot of variability. We got to expect very long droughts. We should not, as a society, we need to be prepared for it. And there's two ways you can prepare for it. One is to build a lot of water infrastructure, most of which is going to be dry for most of a long drought. You don't build reservoirs for a 200-year drought. But you can preserve groundwater to get through 10-year droughts. And then you can try to be wealthy in other regards so that you can move back to Oklahoma if you need to.
One thing that that really stands out is when I talk to people around the country and I hear from these stakeholders and even the general public, they have this feeling that, well, technology will save us, that we're smarter than we were in the 30s, we're smarter than we were in the 50s, we have all this technology behind us, and that's going to save us. And you start thinking that, what has just happened in maybe a 5 or 10 or even a 15-year dry period out in the western U.S. or here on the plains, and how quickly some of these, what we really look at as drought-related impacts, how quickly some of these impacts resonated. And I think there's this false sense of security that if we have a repeat of the 1930s or even the 1950s here in the southern plains, that we'll be able to withstand it, all these impacts because of technology. And I don't think that people realize that some of the mechanisms that are in place were completely related to the Dust Bowl. You know, the idea of having acres set aside and not plowed and having windbreaks and cover crops and stuff like that in the agricultural sector, or even some of the water projects that were developed back in the 30s. It seems like that as the memory of those generations leave us, the reasons to why some of these technologies were used is lost as well. I mean, there's a reason why they weren't growing corn in some of these areas, and there's reasons why different crops were observed in these areas, in different strains of cattle even. And I think we need to be cognitive of when it comes down to Mother Nature, she's going to win. As much as we think we're better than we used to be, and in many ways we are, but I think one thing I always try to relay when I do talk to the media is conservation is always going to be the key. We never know when that next drought is starting. And even if you're not talking drought, just conservation of resources in general is always needed.
I think I'll open up the floor here, and I'll come around and hand you the mic. I'll go over here first. Say your name.
Hi. Hi, I'm Robert McClure from Investigate West in Seattle. And I have actually a follow-up to Doyle's, which is, I want to clarify what you said, Jonathan. I thought you said that you agreed with him, you think he's right about this multi-decade drought, or that the 20th century was anomalously wet. But then later you said that you had some graduate students who had shown that for the Colorado Basin. So that's the first part of the question. And the second part of the question is, how can I get information about this about the Pacific Northwest?
Yeah, so, I would say the results are quite tentative at this point, preliminary. Been presented at AGU, for example, on the overall wetness of the 20th century versus preceding centuries. One of the things that is a little ironic for, or interesting for, the Colorado River Basin is we divided up the water in the 1920s, which is the wettest period in the almost the entire last 1,000 years of the Colorado, as far as we can tell. Okay, How can we bring information like this to Seattle?
Where can I find, who's looking at what happened in paleoclimate in the Northwest in terms of drought? Not you.
You know, I think I would go, he won't know the answer, but he'll know who to go to is Phil Moat at,
okay.
That's at Oregon State.
Good suggestion.
Hi, Carolyn Wetzel from Bloomberg B&A. My question's for Jay. Now that we have these changing, the uncertainty is of the droughts and wet years and such, what do we need to do to fix our infrastructure to respond to these unknowns?
For California's water system, and I think it's probably true for everybody's water system, droughts are not the only things that are important. We have a lot of other changes that occur to these water systems, to our societies, to our economies, over historical time frames. And if you look at the history of water management in California, you see a history of floods, droughts, and lawsuits, right? Because we have these gradual changes in the structure of the economy and the structure of society, the demography, the populations, the society, our expectations, and what we want of the environment changes over these long historical periods. But the floods, the droughts, and the lawsuits provide that crisis that's needed to really get the society involved in a conversation, including the political level. So I think what we're learning out of this particular, and if you look at the last drought, we had a little drought in 2009, and out of that drought came some legislation that required that all the water users report their water use. Wow, what a revolutionary idea for California. And then we get to into this drought, 2014, we curtailed water rights for the first time since 1976. And boy, we were really glad that that previous drought had required the reporting of water use so that we could start curtailing water rights. Out of this drought, we started to realize last year that, wait a minute, groundwater is responsible for 70% of our agricultural response to the drought. And that's what's keeping all the most profitable crops alive. So we had groundwater legislation, something which had people have been trying to do for 100 years without success. I think 6 months before, nobody would have expected that legislation would have passed. So I think we're going to see a tightening of the water rights system further. We're going to see some groundwater management, and over time, and it might take another two or three droughts for this, at least one more drought probably for this, or maybe a couple of years of dryness, to have integration of groundwater and surface water in our water rights system. On all this time, we're seeing urban water conservation increasing. We're seeing greater prices for water in agriculture, that's the best way to get water conservation in agriculture, is to raise the price. We're seeing, I think, a realization that there are some parts of the state where you're going to have to reduce irrigated area in agriculture. There's just, in the long term, there's not going to be enough water permanently, especially when we eliminate overdraft in the Tulare Basin. So quite a few lessons. It's a big state.
I'm Eric Anderson, and I live in San Diego. I have two questions, both concern water supplies. The first is, I'd just like to hear some thoughts on whether or not Lake Mead and Lake Powell will ever be back at full level again. And the second question is, it involves the groundwater in the Central Valley. In some areas, the actual land surface has dropped up to 10 feet. And I just wonder whether or not that's recoverable, or does that represent lost groundwater capacity? Either or.
I'm from Oklahoma.
You're not going to get that groundwater, that surface elevation back. I've been thinking of writing a blog called "The Earth Is Falling." So most of that compaction comes the first time you draw that water down. So it closes up the pore spaces, and mostly in clays actually, and so the first time you draw it down, it consolidates. And then no matter how many times you refill it and draw it down, it doesn't consolidate or rebound hardly at all, relatively. So if you want to prevent land subsidence, then you just can't draw the groundwater down. And there's a great little article on this some time ago that I read as a graduate student called "What's the Aquifer?" You understand that from Oklahoma, right?
Okay.
So you know, it's one of those things. I think it's one of the most visible aspects of our groundwater overdraft problem, but I think it has some importance, but its impacts tend mostly to be on the water delivery channels for surface water and for the flood control channels, because you've interrupted the gradient. So it's really ironic to me that probably the biggest impact of that of the drought in those areas is going to be enhanced problems with flood damage.
Then there was Lake Mead. I totally agree with Jay on the groundwater, and I think it's something we really need to change our perspective in Oklahoma, all the way out to California, probably everywhere else, and in between and outside. You know, is we got to treat these aquifers a lot nicer than we treat them, and they are our ability to store. We can't just keep building dams, you know, that we're running out of sites, and talk about lawsuits. So we can stick the water underground. That's what we do in Arizona. We do have a lot of water we put back underground, and we take the water when we have it and we put it underground. And Nevada gives us water, California, I think, gives us water to store. We store the water and we give it back.
We don't give it. We expect it back.
Oh, yeah. We'll see if that happens.
Probably.
Anyhow, give us your water. No, we get it, give it back. But that's an excellent point. The reason for this is that, you know, our theory of these periods of anomalously dry conditions climatologically go with, come in sequence with anomalously wet periods. You can call them pluvial periods. They don't really have a good name that's widely accepted, but let's call them pluvials. And there is evidence that those exist just as much as mega pluvials, mega droughts. And so in the future, we should still get anomalously wet periods, and we've got to figure out a way to save that water somewhere. And the best place is underground. You bring up where you can, because most of the groundwater we have in places like Oklahoma and Arizona is fossil. You know, the only way we're going to get it back is if we put it there. Mother Nature won't do it on our time scales. Now, Lake Mead or Powell, we this summer, just for a month, hit 1075 feet in Lake Mead, which is the level where there should be a shortage. But of course, it didn't last long because we had Miracle May, the wettest May ever, and a lot of snow in the upper basin that kept bounced us back a little. Will we ever refill it? I think if we did a probability estimate of that, which we should do someday, we'd probably find there is some probability we'll refill that. But I think it's really low. And the reason for that is the Colorado River is already over-allocated by 15-25%, depending on who you are. You know, I think 25% is probably not as defendable as 15%. But even in a good year, more water's been taken out than should be. So I think it'll be really hard to fill that up again.
And we have that same type of problem out in the High Plains with the Ogallala Aquifer, of course, which is being drawn down drastically fast. And it will probably never be replenished, or at least in a time scale that can be used again by current generations once it's gone. And you know, one of the problems out there is you have to get water to actually stand on the surface for very long. It doesn't happen in the High Plains for it to even percolate down and penetrate that particular aquifer, which is covered with clay. So imagine if they had that technology to withdraw that water in the 1930s to counteract the effects of the 1930s Dust Bowl drought. That water might be completely gone by now, because back then they, you know, even in the 50s when they would bring that water up, they would just spray it up into the air out in the High Plains. When you throw water in the air, it goes poof, it goes away. So he's correct, and it's very correct that the only way that's going to replenish is if we put it there. Now, when we talk Oklahoma, if you talk about injecting water into the land, it's a very touchy subject right now, okay? And it's touchy if you don't like earthquakes. So we just won't go there. I'll get in trouble.
Coming like California?
Yeah, exactly.
This is a different kind of injection.
A different injection. Much lower pressure would be nice.
Did you want to say anything, Brian? Or?
No.
Okay.
I'm from Atlanta Straub, a freelancer from West Texas. So I understand the Ogallala and 50-foot drawdowns. And those kind of things. But as the farmers always tell me, they come back in the spring, so don't worry about it. Do you ever see in the near future the laws changing where you have some kind of interstate compact where Texas's law isn't so far away from Oklahoma's law, from Nebraska's water law? Because, I mean, that's the key, right, to get some interstate compacts going on where...
And, of course, you have Texas suing Oklahoma at every turn trying to get our water so they can water their lawns in Fort Worth. And Oklahoma has all this water running down the Red River into the Gulf of Mexico that they don't want to get rid of for some reason. So it's and in some cases, it's just, I think, obstinance. But I have no idea about these, how you can get everybody on the same page with these laws. Oklahoma, you own the water that's underneath your land. You can do whatever you want with it. I think Texas is not that way, correct?
Well, Texas is right of capture. If I can get it, it's mine.
Right, exactly. And so...
Doesn't matter who it belongs to.
Of course, when you see these big droughts occur, lots of laws start to try to be changed, and you see lawsuits between states and even communities. One of the biggest controversies here in Oklahoma, back in 2013, Oklahoma City was very low on water during the drought. There's a Lake Canton up in northwestern Oklahoma. That's part of the Oklahoma City water supply. They said, release all that water from Canton Lake, send it down the Canadian to Oklahoma. Of course, they lose half of it on the trip down. And so Canton loses all its water. The whole northwestern part of the state, that's the main recreational lake for the northwestern corner of Oklahoma. So they go without. Oklahoma City gets all that water from Canton Lake, and then they see people watering their lawns and sailboating on Lake Hefner, which is the water supply here, which it flowed into. So, the lawsuits start flying. I don't know if we can ever get everybody on the same page in these interstate compacts, because each state has such a different, flavor in their legislatures and what they think should be done with their water. But I would certainly hope in the future that, these cooperations between states would help matters when we have things like, Texas in a drought, Oklahoma not in a drought, and then we could start sharing that water.
Just to follow up, do you think it's a valuation issue, the fact that water's free?
Oh, most definitely. Oklahoma could definitely sell that water to Texas, and for some reason they don't want to, because they worry about what's going to happen if we become in a drought, and we need that water, and Texas...
We're going to keep it. We're not going to sell it back.
Exactly. Well, it's the same thing. Oklahoma City took Canton's water. Canton had no idea that was going to happen, and they had the rights to it, and once you have the rights, it's their right to the water.
One thing I learned last year is that the definition of waste, wasted water is water used by somebody else. And I think it's always the case. And on the side of buying and selling water, we've found water markets to be pretty useful in civilizing the conversation in California. Not perfect. We've got a long way to go. But if you've got an alternative, if you have several ways you can get water, usually you can pay a lot of money for infrastructure or drill deeper wells. You can buy water from somebody else, or you can sue them for a decade. If you can buy and sell it from somebody else, it's often a more civilized way to do things.
You can do it the way Tom Selleck did, I suppose.
I'm Michael Martz from the Richmond Times-Dispatch. I have a question for Gary. I was down at we did a tour yesterday at the Chickasaw National Recreational Area. And our guide was a Choctaw Indian who was really concerned about harbingers of what might be to come. He feels like it's more intuitive than anything else, things that are happening later than they normally do. But I said, well, your family's been here for eight generations. How does it compare with previous droughts? And they said the 50s was actually worse. So then the question, I guess, is are there concerns of the climate change that could worsen worsen future droughts here in Oklahoma? Are we talking cycles?
Well, it's partly natural cycles, of course, tied to things like ENSO and the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, also the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. All those fancy terms, with their teleconnections, tend to influence the weather not only here in the Southern Plains in Oklahoma, but across the entire United States and across the world. So there are cycles, of course. In the 1950s, we were in the unfavorable oceanic pattern. From basically 50 through 75, we were in unfavorable patterns, and we had a period of 25 to 30 years there of very dry weather. The 50s was the worst because it was coupled with heat. Now, it was dry in the 60s and 70s, too, but it was cooler than normal then. As I mentioned previously, in the 80s through the mid-2000s, we were in a favorable oceanic pattern, and it was what we would call a pluvial, where we had the above normal precipitation. Now, the thing that's changing, though, with the temperatures, you can have an increase in the amount of precipitation on an annual basis, on a multi-annual basis, and still have severe drought due to an increase in temperature, especially if all that water comes in a very short time frame like it did this year. Again, we've had more than our normal amount of precipitation for the state as a whole just from April through July, and now here we are with drought starting to rise up from the south again, and basically the southern third of the state is once again in drought. So all the projections, and it's very iffy still on precipitation. It's very regionalized. The science really does need to get better when they do the climate projections for precipitation. But we do know that the Earth just about everywhere is going to warm as we go into the future. And so, you know, the message we try to give is that ordinary droughts will be transformed into more severe droughts. Periods that might not have been as prone to drought might be transformed into, you know, your ordinary everyday drought. It's definitely something that's on the minds of the citizens of Oklahoma. All you have to do is look back at the summer of 2011, an ordinary drought in the state of Oklahoma. Now, we can't blame this on climate change, but an ordinary drought started out in October 2010. It progressed into the spring, and then in the summer of 2011, Oklahoma had the hottest summer on record for any state in the history of the United States. The June through August statewide average temperature, we were hotter than any other state in the history, at least dating back to 1895. And not just by a little bit, by well over a degree. So that just normal drought was transformed into a devastating drought that we still have not recovered from. And in 2012, we had our warmest year on record. So the heat and drought go hand in hand, especially when you talk about the severity of the drought. So when we start to look at those projections in the future, even if we have a greater annual precipitation totals, that does not mean that we will have an end to drought. We can still have those droughts or even mega droughts during those types of precipitation type events.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I mean, that those warm temperatures are at least partly due to humans, right? And again, like we said this morning, single events are not all natural or all human caused. It's a mix now. In the drought world, what we really have to worry about in the future, as much as anything, is the temperature increases. So that's what's going to, I think you did an excellent job of explaining how it's going to really change the nature of drought, and not in a good way.
I've had too much practice over the last, too many talks over the last 5 years giving that same message.
We've got another interesting wrinkle on the temperatures, which we're pretty sure is going to happen, or very sure is going to happen. In California, we have irrigated agriculture, we're less susceptible to the kind of droughts you see here. But there's a colleague, Jan Hopmans, he and his student did a study where they looked at the increase in temperatures, and they found that that makes the crop evapotranspiration rates go up, as you'd expect. But the higher temperatures also shorten the time that the crop needs to come to maturity. To give about the same total water use for some crops, at least, to come to maturity. And so you think, oh, well, that's not so bad for climate change. And then you sit back and you think, well, wait a minute, in California that means you might want to go from a single cropping to double cropping. So now you'd have twice as much water, and the temperature problem is not the loss of water, but it is you've made that land twice as profitable for agriculture. And therefore, if you don't have the water, you've doubled the impact, more than doubled the impact. So it's really, it's kind of perverse and a little strange at times.
One thing that has happened is through, and this is really in the agricultural sector, and really the grain or row crop agriculture in the Midwest and the Central Plains, is Through time, through genetic manipulation and whatnot, there has been progressions made in corn and soybeans, and throughout the history, we know that, you know, critical periods exist for both crops. Well, as we see these temperatures changing, all of a sudden we see, you know, if you look at the USDA hardiness zones and the release that came out, the most recent release, we've seen all those zones shift to the north. And so now all of a sudden we have areas that are able climatologically to grow crops that before they weren't suited to grow those crops just based on the length of the growing season. So as we increase temperatures, we're also changing the agricultural landscape, where all of a sudden we're seeing corn in North Dakota and Minnesota becoming players in the U.S. grain markets, where traditionally they were smaller grains and different types of crops like canola, sugar beets, etc. And so as we continue to change the landscape, again, it goes back to those lessons that we learned in the 30s and the 50s during some of these drought periods, that all of a sudden the drought in North Dakota in, say, 2020 compared to the drought in North Dakota in 2040 or in 1940 are completely two different beasts, because we've changed the way that we started producing on these lands. And so all of a sudden this institutional knowledge, that I'd call it, is somewhat lost, because we're in a new realm that, again, as we go into these drought periods that may be extended, they may be more commonplace, we really don't know what it's going to mean for some of these landscapes, because we're in some uncharted areas.
Okay. Heraclitus said that you never step on the same river twice. I think the same is true for droughts. You never have the same drought twice. Even in the same drought, no 2 years are the same.
My name is Cynthia Barnett. I'm an independent journalist who covers water. And I had one question for Professor Overpeck and then one question for the whole panel. For Peck, my question is, by the way, I love the word pluvial. I can't believe you don't like that word. I think it's a great word.
I didn't say I didn't like it. I just said it isn't widely used in Sudegadra.
Maybe we can change that. My question is, in the paleoclimate record, have there been mega droughts and major pluvials at the same time on the Earth?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, so one of the interesting things is climate changes in terms of the hydroclimate. There are wetter places and anomalously wet places and anomalously dry places, mega droughts and pluvials, at the same time. And I'm trying to think of a good example of that, but without any doubt, you're just moving the water around.
Yeah. And my question for the whole panel, which sort of jumps off what Brian Fuchs was just saying, I live in rainy Florida, and during the great drought in the Texas Panhandle, we saw a lot of proposals for grass-fed cattle operations moving into North Florida, and I wondered if the panelists could address whether you have seen those types of economic climate migrations already in your communities.
Oh, most definitely. In the 2011-2012 period, cattle herds that have been bred over the bloodlines of those cattle herds that have been bred for decades were absolutely decimated. In 2011, the farmers in Oklahoma, or the ranchers, they would send their cattle, if they had the money, up into areas like Nebraska, where Brian's from, Iowa, Illinois, to be fed up there at feedlots. And so that was one loss. And in 2012, when the entire Great Plains, including Oklahoma and Texas, they were all in drought, there was nowhere to send the cattle from Oklahoma or Texas or any of those other places. You just had to sell your cattle, and they went to slaughter. And so Oklahoma actually, for that 2011 through 2014 period, I'm not sure of the number of cattle, but we certainly had the most aid from the federal government given to this state for the loss of forage program, which directly is a result of the loss of forage for cattle, over $750 million over that time frame. So you have lifetime ranchers that, first, they're upset about the loss of their ability to grow feed or grain or whatever they're growing, but they're more upset and devastated by the loss of those cattle herds, the lineage of those cattle herds that have been bred over decades, which is really, for a lot of those folks, it's their pride and joy. So those type of economic impacts we most definitely felt. 2011, 2012, over $2 billion in damage, agricultural damage alone just in those 2 years in Oklahoma. I think Texas, it was over $6 billion. A lot of that was cattle.
During that same time as this cattle migration was leaving the southern plains, there was a study done by the Texas AgriLife, which is basically the University of Texas Extension Group. And they were looking at this cattle migration, and what they were showing was that for all these cattle that got shipped out in 2011, 2012, be it to the Central Plains or even up into the Northern Plains and into some of the Northern Rocky Mountains areas, that the majority of those cattle were never going to come back. And so it was not this idea that we're going to ship them off and then bring them back, that, like Gary said, the bloodlines were lost. A lot of these multi-generation ranches completely went under. And yes, there was relief provided by the federal government with different programs and that, but you're talking about some of these operations that you just don't rebound from. It was very, very much a situation where not only were the economics impacted, but also the livelihood of some of these regions. And what we're seeing is, like you mentioned, North Florida as far as sending cattle to, and as we've seen these droughts pop up, the idea of, is there a better place to be doing some of this? Is there other areas to be doing this? And again, it's economics. If it's possible, you're going to see people doing it. And you may definitely see that some areas pick up production of livestock that traditionally haven't been. Or you may see areas that have been that go out because of just the climate and a lot of it due to drought.
Hi, Dennis Dimmick from National Geographic. I've covered a lot of water-related issues in the West, primarily because I am from the West, and I guess I'm one subset of this question about drought has to do with this idea that the West was built on the back of snowpack, and that as temperatures go up, we see a decrease in the amount of snowpack that we're getting, and an increase in that precipitation if it's coming. If it comes at all in the winter, increasingly as rain. What does that mean long-term for sort of water management and supply questions for the Intermountain West, the Pacific States, California, and like, for example, the Northwest? We saw that the precipitation came down this year, but it came down as rain more so than as snow.
In California, which I know best, in the modeling we do, when we look at this, you can see two distinct effects of the loss of snowpack. One is the temperature effect, which increases the evapotranspiration off the whole watershed. So you lose probably, 7-10% of the runoff because of the higher temperatures. And then there's a seasonal shift, which really, at least in California, accelerates the runoff by maybe a month on that order. In most of California, the reservoirs are big enough so that most of the time you can catch up, you can pick up that seasonal shift. Now, in really wet years, it means you can't catch as much water. So it's inconvenient but not fatal, is the way that I would look at it. And the 10% loss, 7-10% loss of water volume, that's the bigger effect than the seasonal shift in terms of water supply. If you go up to the Pacific Northwest, the reservoirs tend to be smaller relative to the mean annual flow. It's going to be harder to pick that up. They'll have some hydropower loss, more hydropower losses in particular. Flood operations is going to be a little more interesting. That's going to be true for California, too. In California, one of the major ways that you get by with the R-sized reservoirs with this new hydrology is you try to move your drought storage out of reservoirs into groundwater. And if you do that, then it becomes inconvenient and not catastrophic.
in the Colorado Basin, we have it quantified pretty well, and it's a little different. Published a paper last year in Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society, BAMS, a whole bunch of authors trying to get at the answer of how devastating is temperature, how big a role does temperature play in stream flow reductions. In this case, the stream happens to be the Colorado, a pretty big stream. And it appears that for every degree warming, we get about 6.5% reduction in river flow, plus or minus 3.5%. So you can see the numbers get pretty big pretty fast if we get more warming. And in that paper, we make the case that most of that sensitivity, not all, but most, is connected with snow. This is also connected with, you know, as things get warmer, you get green up. Spring begins earlier, and the plants use more moisture, and that doesn't get into the river. As the temperature goes up, you get more evaporation. So there are the other effects, but it all comes up to a fairly large number that is related to snow. And the second thing we haven't mentioned is that, and this is true for the Pacific Northwest as well as everywhere else, is it's not just the water supply, it's our ecosystems, our landscapes. And as we're losing snow, particularly at mid-elevations, right, because the highest elevations are still keeping their snow, it's so cold, but it's at the mid and low elevations where we're losing the snowpack now because of warming. We're drying out the soil earlier in the season. We're starting plant growth earlier in the season, which exacerbates that even further. And we're basically starting our fire seasons a month and a half, 2 months earlier. So snow is incredibly important out our way. And this whole effect of the rain, Pacific Northwest showed, is not only is rain not as good as snow for water supply and natural ecosystems, it also, of course, rains on the snow that you do get, and that further erodes your snowpack, and you know, it exacerbates the problem.
Any more questions from the audience? Anybody? You had a question.
Thanks. Robert McClure, Investigate West, Seattle. So my question is about public reactions, and it's for Gary and for Brian. So Gary, you said that you've given all these talks, and what do you say in the state to people about the role of humans in climate change, and how is that received? And Brian, when you tell people that technology ain't going to save us, the stakeholders and common people who say that, what kind of reaction are you getting?
Well, when I give a climate change talk, or I'm asked about climate change in one of my drought talks, I merely give them the most recent and the best peer-reviewed science. I tell them I have no advocacy in that area. That's the safest way for me to do that. Let's put it that way. And that this is simply the science. It's for you to either accept or ignore. It's very well understood. It's ratified by nearly every major scientific organization across the world. However, this is Oklahoma, so they don't listen to every major scientific organization around the world. So it's not always accepted as well in this part of the country as other parts. But all I can do is give the most recent and the best information possible. You know, how's it accepted? Some folks appreciate it. Some folks definitely don't. But if we can just get the point across that climate is changing, I think that we're a step ahead there to maybe break them out of the pattern that they were in from, again, I hate to keep saying this, but from 80 to 2005 or so, where we had abundant water, and get them to start thinking about how climate is not static, how it is dynamic and always changing. And then, you know, sometime in the future, maybe the conversation will progress with exactly what's causing those changes.
Just to add on Gary's answer, and then I'll answer the one directed at me, is, yeah, I was just up in North Dakota week before last, and was invited to give a talk, and this, the same thing, sometimes this topic is sensitive. So going into a talk like that, I generally am the same way. I put the science out there. I don't make
I don't pound my hand on the table and say this is happening. I show the evidence and I tell the audience, make your own conclusions. I go, here's what the numbers are showing. And I put up the charts and show the trends, and I do it by annual, seasonal, and different periods to just show them it just isn't one time a year. You know, in North Dakota, I said, your winters are warmer by about 5 degrees. And I go, yeah, you're going to run me out of the room right now, but I go, here's the data. And we talked about precipitation the same way. And then a lot of times I'll go to the stakeholders and say, well, what have you noticed that has changed? Are you putting crops in the field sooner? Are you making water calls at different times of the year? You're already recognizing and dealing with these changes, even if you don't want to acknowledge peer-reviewed science. And so a lot of times I'll push that back to them after I've presented that same type of evidence to them. Now, as far as technology goes, I just try to, my message has always been conservation planning is going to go a long way. And I bring up the fact that we learned a lot of lessons in the 30s and in the 50s, and we need to remember those lessons. And I think people are in this instant gratification type of world that, you know, I pick up my phone, all my answers are solved. I make a phone call, I call Gary up, he has all the answers for Oklahoma. You know, we know that's not the case. And so I think the message I try to bring out is we need to learn from past events, we need to be prepared for future events, and the way we do that is by taking note of what has happened in the past, what we currently are seeing, and what's projected into the future. And that some of these problems we encounter just are not going to be able to be solved with a snap of a finger, that there's going to be a lot that goes into those.
Yeah, this is interesting because there's a lot of debate in the scientific community, I think, about how to approach public audiences in the red states in particular. And it's often, some of my colleagues say, well, talk about drought, don't talk about climate change. But I don't know which of our states is more red, Arizona, Oklahoma, Nebraska. You know, so I live in a pretty red state. We just published a survey. We did a very detailed survey of public perceptions on climate change in Arizona. It was published this spring. And we did it with Stanford's John Krosnick. So he, you know, we had like one of the climate survey pros helping. And what do you think the public in Arizona is thinking on climate change? Well, it's a large majority of Arizona public thinks climate change is happening. Large majority thinks it's at least partly due to humans. And a majority thinks both the state and federal government should do something about it. Okay, that's in wacky Arizona. And I think we're underestimating our public. And I think we're often being, and I do a lot of public engagements too. So, I think we're underestimating how they sense this problem versus our politicians. And the fact that our politicians need to raise lots of money, I'm not saying good or bad, I'm just telling you the way I think it works. And therefore, they are a little more responsible to toe the line of their donors, I guess, in terms of what their line is on climate. But I think in our states, people are, you know, I had a very, my wife's family's from Missouri, and farmers and ranchers up there, and, you know, these guys, they know things are up, something's up here. They know it's a problem. So I do not pull punches when I talk to the public anymore. I talk about climate change in Arizona in the most conservative group as I would with the most liberal group in California.
Must be tenured. Huh? Must be tenured.
I just got a real quick question. Bob Henson from Weather Underground. It occurs to me, and I'm curious what you all think, I'm wondering whether the intensified swings from very wet years to very dry periods or in intensified drought periods due to temperature, if that's exacerbating the idea that people have, some folks, that it's all just a cycle. You know, could it be that the intensification of cyclic aspects, you know, in addition to the long-term changes, is that perhaps making it easier for people to say, oh, it's all just a cycle, we've always had cycles?
Well, yeah, that's exactly what I hear constantly from the public in Oklahoma when I give all these talks, regardless of what causes it. But, you know, if you look at the 1950s drought and the end of that drought, it almost exactly mirrors this drought that we just had. We had very severe 4 to 5 year drought ended by absolutely ridiculous rainfall over a 3 to 4 month period, just like exactly what we had So we can say, you know, this was very much like the 1950s drought, very much like the 1950s end of that drought. But we have to get the point across. It's not necessarily because of the same reason. It's a whole, like I say, it's a whole different world from the 50s to the type of atmosphere and the land use and the change in albedo even up in the northern parts of the northern hemisphere and what we saw in the 1950s. So in some ways, you have to acknowledge, yeah, that is natural cycles, and that will always control a certain extent of our weather, but you know, there's something else coming down the road.
And it might be a more variable hydroclimate. In the most recent paper I've read on California's situation, using our most advanced model, suggests we're going to have just a more dry and more extreme wet. You know, and then of course you're going to have the temperature increases, which are going to make that extreme dry pretty darn extreme.
But it's hard to detect that statistically.
Yes.
It's hard to detect that statistically because our climate was already very variable.
Yeah.
So, you know, we just have to be prepared for a lot more stuff.
And there's a lot of work. This science is really in its infancy right now, but people like Jennifer Francis up at Rutgers is studying the impacts of how are the loss of Arctic ice up in that area changing the jet stream, the jet stream patterns. Why is the stickiness of the jet stream patterns suddenly occurring where the eastern half of the United States is under a perennial a low pressure or an atmospheric a trough, and the west is under this ridge for so long, and Oklahoma is stuck in the middle, and wherever that deflection point goes, that's what our weather ends up being. And so we really do need to progress that type of the science, the regional aspects of the science, where we've progressed in the global aspects of the science over the last 20 to 30 to 40 years.
And just to be brief, since I know we're at our time, but you know, Gary and I sat at a meeting back in 2012 in Fort Worth, and the idea was, well, let's, as scientists, document this event, and let's write a report about the Southern Plains drought. And it's a good idea, because the idea is, if we don't document these events and learn from them, how do we address them going forward? And so in that one, we sat down and we had it written to include 2011, and we were going to release it in 2012, but you know, here the drought continued to 2015. So here the same report, we're going to be finishing it up here, hopefully early 16, and put it out there. And we did a similar report in the Central Plains for the 2011-2012, where they went from from flood in 11 to drought in 2012. And we had 15 states, and we put together a 120-page report, state by state. What did the drought mean in those states? And so, as I think we need to continue documenting them to learn about these swings one way or the other, and be better prepared, better informed. And again, you get decision makers looking at some of this, and the stakeholders looking at some of this. They can react better at that point then as well.
Well, I realize in the title here I said mega droughts, a threat to civilization. I hope that wasn't hyperbole. And just to wrap it up, is there a realistic chance that it is some sort of a threat to civilization, or is that a little beyond the pale, perhaps? That was a quote from a scientist, Toby Ault.
No, I think again with the climate, you can never say never, and again, how we adapt and adjust, I think we have the ability to do so versus in paleo times or other periods, but I think we can adapt and at least overcome some of what would be seen if we did encounter a mega drought.
Yeah, I think it's a threat to some types of civilization, some aspects of our civilization, the cattle ranching in some areas, the salmon in some areas. But I think California is going to remain a pretty popular place no matter what, even if we have to desalt seawater.
When I give talks, I tend to talk about it, these types of droughts in terms of society, and I say these are society-changing droughts. So the 1930s and 1950s drought, the 30s we had mass migration of people out west, the 1950s we had the same problem occur down in Texas with that we saw in the Dust Bowl drought. So I don't think civilization, at least in the Western world, is that endangered. I just think it will be different. Now, if it was the 1100, 1200 type period out with the cliff dwellers out in the desert southwest, then that would be a civilization ender for those folks. But for us, I don't think it's a civilization ender. I think it's a civilization changer.
That is a good way to say it. You know, and Toby Alt was one of our students. He's also the one who got you to put a great white shark of climate on your front.
That was a good quote that he had there, the great white shark of climate.
Yeah. I love that one. So, but I don't, I think I agree with these guys. Not a threat, but I do think we should keep an eye out for the fact that it's easy for us to say this in a technologically rich country, and that there are going to be other places around the world, like in the Sahel, West Africa, parts of Asia, where, and some island nations, frankly, where they could really get hammered and not have the wherewithal to deal with it the way we would. And so it's our, we sort of have a responsibility, particularly as, since we're the cause of this temperature increases that are going to make it a lot worse for them too. We have some responsibility to share our technology and know-how with them. And fortunately, that's what we're doing.
Well, thank you very much to our panelists today. Give them a big round of applause. Thanks to Peck and Gary and Jay and Brian. And I've been told that the plenary is next at 3:30. At the moment, I don't know what it is, but I'm sure it's great. Somebody will tell you. But the plenary is over in the ballroom. So thanks very much. What's in your email?